Welcome to the Approaching the Natural podcast with Sid Garza-Hillman and sponsored by the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. Sid is a certified nutritionist, health coach, and author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, out now on Roundtree Press. Sid is also the programs director at the Stanford Inn's Mendocino Center for Living Well, one of the most holistic and integrated wellness centers in the country. The Approaching the Natural podcast explores all aspects of human health, including nutrition, movement, mindfulness, art, and much more.
Hello, welcome everybody, and welcome back. If you've been with me before, this is Sid Garza-Hillman, and you're listening to the Approaching the Natural podcast. And couple quick announcements, and I want to get right to this conversation, which was just turned out to be what I had hoped it would be. Anyway, so to that in a second. A couple announcements. Following me on Twitter at Sid Garza-Hillman, Instagram at Sid Garza-Hillman, Facebook, Transitioning to Health. My private practice is transitioningtohealth.net. I work with people all over the country. And this podcast is dedicated to moving people past the diet paradigm and quick fix paradigm in general. I am the small step advocate. I am constantly fighting to have people take little steps, manageable ones that they can do every day. And we build into it that way. And with success in things like weight loss become incidental. And the real value is in the empowerment that you achieve from this way of doing things. So anyway, that's if you're new to this podcast, go back and check out the ones that have led up to here and you can get a sense of where I come down on things. I do want to make a side note. There's a guy I want to send a nice thanks to, Fat to Plant. He's a follower on Twitter and he has a blog, and he, I got hacked. My Twitter feed, my Twitter account got hacked, and he caught it right away and sent me a quick message, and I was able to, I think, take care of it. But the funny thing is I wanted to really thank him because I think he knew it was spam, because it was a fastest way to weight loss was the thing with a link. And so I was kind of happy that he gave me the benefit of the doubt, you know, and was like, this can't be Sid, you know, whereas like, I think actually a couple of people stopped following me because they were like, all of a sudden he's advocating for diets. He must need to upgrade his minivan. But anyway, that's, I just wanted to say thank you for catching that so fast. But I just thought that was kind of funny that was the spam that was used on my account. Neither here nor there. I'm going to be in Berkeley on January 25th. You can go to vegfoodevents.com/health to find out about the Plant-Powered Fitness and Health Expo. I'll be there speaking on the 25th and of this month, and also the retreat. I think there's a couple openings still for the Transitioning to Health retreat here at the Stanford Inn. Not here because I'm not there, but lastly, the Stanford Inn is the sponsor of this podcast. So with that said, meditation is something that's come up in a few of the episodes that I've done, and I have threatened to do an episode on meditation, and this is going to serve as that episode. What I did is I went to Jeff Stanford, and he is the owner of the Stanford Inn, but you know, real quick kind of history is that I you know, head up the wellness center there. I've known him for 7 years. We've you know, get into very interesting conversations, many of which helped me hone the message in my book. Just, you know, it's just a constant conversation, nutrition, health, all in general. He's been meditating for almost 40 years, and or actually probably even longer. And I thought it would be an interesting perspective. I did learn a whole nother way of thinking about meditation through Jeff, and I wanted him to explain what that is. He has coached people in meditation and some other things as well. So real quick, just a couple things about Jeff. He was trained as an anthropologist focusing on religion and culture, and he did field work in the 1970s human potential movement. He studied the cultural context of enlightenment, learning to distinguish among a variety of cognitive states, whether or not pharmacologically induced, and their relation to culture and the individual. He has his master's degree in anthropology, which I find interesting because he comes to some things from that from that starting point. And so anyway, I thought, you know what, let me turn on the microphone, see how it goes, really talk about what he definitely showed me with regards to meditation that I think really applies to I mean, I talk about it in the book, and it applies to my approach in general. So without much further ado, we'll jump right in. This is my conversation with Jeff Stanford and about meditation and contemplation and more. I hope you enjoy. No, so
it's actually true.
I know. I don't doubt it. And I don't doubt it. Which actually, it's funny that you say that, because part of what we've talked about and part of what I talk about in the podcast is truth and authenticity. And so I think meditation, for somebody who can meditate, just because they meditate doesn't mean that they're anything. And they could be doing that as a distraction or with a motive that has nothing to do with health and happiness or balance or anything else.
Or you can just say that you do it. And since meditation is really essentially thinking, and one of the things that we're going to do is define the nature of that thinking later on.
Right.
But since it's thinking, everybody meditates, or at least we think they do, but we really don't know what their personal experience is. But we assume that they meditate because they must be thinking.
Yeah, but you've distinguished between meditation and contemplation. So I kind of want to start there, because obviously with regards to health and happiness, how that plays into the human's experience in the world, in the modern world especially, how do you see the difference there between those two concepts?
Contemplation.
And meditation.
And meditation. Those terms are used interchangeably by most people, and I try to distinguish, so I'll play with words, the difference between, say, object meditation or object contemplation. Contemplating your breath, or meditating your breath on your breath, or paying attention to it, as opposed to non-object meditation, which is just being aware of what's going on around you. That's a non-object meditation, because it's continuous with your ordinary life.
Okay, so but like if when you're talking about, see, I think contemplation, I think I'm maybe thinking about my breath. But I'm not necessarily just sitting listening to my breath, which seems to be more meditative than contemplative. Is there a distinction?
I'm willing to go with that distinction.
Okay. So contemplation would be you, and it can be with intention. You can say, I'm really going to think about my own health and happiness. So I'm gonna think on that. So it's not like daydreaming or just, you know, tangent kind of thinking. It's like intentional, I'm gonna think about this thing. But then how would you distinguish that's kind of a meditation, though. So we just talked yesterday. You were like, I meditated on that for a while. Like you'll talk about that. So what is that? How does that play for you? What does that mean for you? Is that different than contemplation?
Well, what I believe I was talking about was the nature of consciousness. So I would say that you can use, it was an object meditation is what I was talking about. I was thinking about the nature of my consciousness and whether or not I could understand or know the consciousness of another. And I tried to understand in those days what the limits of that consciousness could be, and I could find no limits. So that when you look or study or contemplate on contemplation or contemplate on consciousness or meditate on consciousness, it's really thinking about. The other kind of meditation, the more radical kind, is just observing, the kind the Buddha Siddhartha talked about, or Krishnamurti. That's just observing without making distinctions, without judgment.
Okay, so let's go into that a little deeper. And I want to, because you introduced me to Krishnamurti, but I'd like people to, you know, briefly, how did you get introduced to his philosophy? What about that was appealing to you? What did it say to you, speak to you? I mean, what you've told me and what I've read, obviously, really, really speaks to me with regards to this podcast and my own practice a lot. So how did you stumble upon
that? I did not stumble upon Krishnamurti. My father introduced me to Krishnamurti probably when I was around 18. And it was, I read a little bit of him, and it was very obtuse to me. What I was trying to do was to understand meditation, which is something that my father was trying to do. or working with or doing. I wouldn't have known because he didn't talk to me about his personal life that much. But he was a big advocate of meditation, and I don't know what was the nature of his experience of it at that time. He himself had some difficulties trying to understand where Krishnamurti was going in those years that I was in college and graduate school. The thing that I learned is that, at first, that meditation was like daydreaming. It was, I used to listen to classical music when I needed a break from ordinary life. Instead of listening to the radio, which was rock in those days, I just put on some classical album and listen to that and get transported away. And I thought that that was pretty much what they might be talking about in terms of meditation. As a teenager, that's what I thought it must be. I also thought it was probably like daydreaming, which I did in my Russian history class, for example, where your mind just floats. I might be looking at a pencil point and just looking at it, and I get sucked into the pencil point, and I find myself later on in a different kind of space and being returned to the classroom if somebody asked me a question. What I found interesting, though, was I was very good at answering the questions, even though I seemed not to be there for a while. So there's several different things going on, and I started looking at that activity, trying to understand it, and I am still trying to understand it.
Okay. And so, but with regards to Krishnamurti, what about that? So when you got introduced to Krishnamurti, you thought, you know, the classical music and the just being, you know, taking yourself away from us, you know, just getting out there. But then Krishnamurti talks about, in a way, just being present, right? And so
absolutely.
That's a different. Okay, so how did that? Well, when did that realization come in? Where we were like, well, what's this?
Well, presentness is. I can't even begin to describe that. I've had it, and most people have had experience of being totally present, where you're just everything. I mean, I don't know how to go into that, but I can tell you my evolution with this kind of thing, how I moved forward with it. What I've read, when I read Krishnamurti, I got that he's also talking about conflict, that the problems in life, because he addresses the problems in life, whether it be national life or personal life, and he takes it all down to oneself. And he said, the problem is conflict. And I got that. I realized that the problem was conflict. And his solution to conflict was not to judge it, not to think about it, but just to look at your life and see where the conflict is. And then he said something really remarkable, and you can get it by going to the online sources for Krishnamurti, because they actually will post to you every day. What he said was, if you see that conflict and really look at it, if you use Heinlein's term from the 50s or 60s, whenever he wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, grok it, you know, really get into it and see that conflict, there's no choice. All of a sudden, you'll see a path of action. It's quite spontaneous, and you move that way. And that's absolutely liberating. And when you do one, you get that deeply into it, and you go once there in that direction, and I can describe what happened to me, your life starts changing in a radical and unexpected ways. So that was my experience. When you start looking at your life and observing it, and you'll see the conflicts, they start arising, and you start dealing with them. And you deal with them, they dissolve. And that's how you deal with them. You deal with them like Superman's X-ray vision. You just keep looking at it.
Okay, so then to go from there to, I mean, that, so would you consider that a meditation? I mean, I know what, I don't want to talk about semantics per se, but I'll tell you what I'm getting at, and then you can sort of fill in the blanks. What I'm getting at is there's looking at, there's being present, there's being aware, like the witnessing of your conflict, let's say, but then there's the sitting on the pillow looking at the candle, and obviously there's benefit to that too.
Very relaxing.
Right, and so what is, but that's not looking at conflict, that's not result, that's not listening necessarily to what
that's actually outside of life or out of your ordinary
okay,
life.
That's what I want to get right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't sit around and look at candles, although I have done it, and I've done it with kids when I used to lead groups. It works in terms of calming people down and making them available to some process that you want to enter into. But that's not what I'm talking about in terms of meditation. Meditation essentially should become an ongoing process that is always with you. And when you find yourself angry, or you find yourself in some kind of turmoil, or find yourself nearly falling asleep just because you're bored, if you bring your mind back to just observing that you're falling asleep, that you're bored, that you're angry, it changes the characteristics of that event. Everything changes then. And that, to me, is active meditation, which Jack Schwartz, who used to operate from here in the 90s, taught. And he wrote a book called Active Meditation.
And was that Krishnamurti based?
No, he wrote that probably before he knew much about Krishnamurti, although he did meet him. And I can't speak for Jack, but it's basically the same thing. It's active meditation, being present in the moment, and the moment is whatever you're doing. It's not, and that's also looking at the candle and observing yourself looking at the candle. I mean, that's really what this form of meditation is. It's a matter of being present in the moment with whatever it is that's going on. And that's fine. If you're thinking about the past and worrying about what you should have said something better in a radio interview such as this, then it's your present moment, and observe it that way. But you can observe it. You're not really forming a separate witness. It's an ongoing process of integration. Everything's integrating within you.
So go into that a little deeper, because that was going to be my next question, which is that I think the perception is that, of course, you're witnessing the thought, and therefore there's a separate entity in the witness, and then there's another separate entity doing the thinking. And we've talked about it a little bit. I'd like if you could clarify that for people, how you understand that to be. I mean, there's no opposition.
No.
Okay, so I'd like to...
First of all, if there's no opposition, you're kind of encompassing and holding like a bowl both the thing you're doing and the person you that are doing it, and you're the bowl that holds it. You're beginning to identify, in a sense, with that bowl, but that bowl is made up of the thing that's being done and the person that's doing it, you. I don't know how to explain it, because it's quite radical, and there is no metaphor that I can think of that really will cover it. There's nothing in quantum physics or anything like that. It is something that happens when you develop a sensitive mind that observes. It just happens. And what happens is you don't, or at least for me, I don't see when this is going on, this is a lot, I don't see the world as in parts. It's almost like the tree that I see and everything it takes to know the tree arises simultaneously, and I'm part of it. I'm not separate from that. I have no extra witness. I've not created another energy source or little vortex of energy that's witness. That's not what's happening. What's happening is I'm actually participating in that awareness and that knowledge, and it's really awesome. I'm hardly there, but it does happen, and it's always a surprise, and it's always wonderful.
But you know, when it comes, like when I, because obviously I'm coaching people to learn healthier, you know, easing their way into health and happiness and things like that. There's a constant, and it obviously comes from childhood and things like that, but there's messaging that we hear in our heads. We hear people that have, let's say, addiction to food and all these kinds of things. We hear you're fat, you're ugly, in our own minds. You're fat, you're ugly. You can't do this. You failed at this diet. I mean, I deal with failure a lot. Perfect, you know, you didn't have a perfect day. So who... How would you explain, like, who are you talking to in your own head when you go, you're fat, why can't you do this? Why can't you do this better? You know, there is a perceived duality. There's a perceived, I'm telling my other thing to do better. And how can you use what you do as a way for people to reconcile those things and become more at peace with the mechanism or whatever, however you see
that? Well, as far as I'm concerned, you just describe you observing, or one of your clients observing that they're doing it and not judging it, realizing that they learned that. And when you get deeply into it, they'll realize that they've learned everything. They've learned that they are the loser that their parents probably mistakenly convinced them of because they didn't do something the parent wanted. And somehow many of us grab onto the negative. We hear our fathers saying, it happened to me. You're just a piece of shit, because he was angry about something and really had nothing to do with me. But you take that home, and then you try to prove him right. You make that part of you. But if you start observing that goes away. and you can make your dad happy in life or as if you passed on, to know that you've gotten beyond that, because it was never intended. I think most of us never intend to damage our children, but we all do. It just happens.
Right, which, I mean, of course, and what I've talked about is the happier and healthier you are in a person, you know, minimizes those times where you're in a crappy mood and you take it out on your kids. You know, I mean, getting yourself in a place where that's those messages don't come
through. That's true, but none of us are saints.
For sure.
And I don't think there's ever been a saint, although every now and then somebody writes a novel that suggests that somebody's so perfect. But I want to empower my kids to undo the damage that I've done. Right. I want to empower the employees or the staff or the interns that come here to undo the damage that I might do or might have done or their parents have done or their teachers or their spouses or girlfriends, whatever, because there's a lot of damage out there and you want to give them power. And I find the most effective power is this kind of, whatever you want to call it, meditation, contemplation, of observing yourself and not judging yourself. But you want to have that alertness. You want to see that conflict. You are holding that in there. You're saying to yourself in a very deep place, I want to look for what really I'm stumbling on and then just see it so I understand it. And understanding is the great dissolver. It's the great acetone for glue, the glue of all the harm that we've been all the harm that we carry around with ourselves.
So when you were talking about your staff and your kids and things like that, I obviously have kids too. I'll put it this way. I mean, I think it takes an effort to even get to the point where you understand that while you might make efforts to make yourself in a good mood all the time, that that's impossible and that there is damage to be done. There's a certain freedom and liberation in that. I mean, that in and of itself, from what you've told me already, I mean, that is part of the being present, acknowledging. So, but I guess my question is, how is there not guilt around that? Like, you know that there's damage, or that you're doing damage, or that you have inflicted damage. And how can you not feel bad about that? Or I'm getting to this because I deal with people all the time and they just feel crappy because they feel like they're failures and they can't do it and all this kind of stuff. And then how can people work on the point of going, I just want to see this?
Okay. Let's start with that. How do you know? Okay. So you perceive that you've done something wrong. You eat too much food because you're dealing with people with weight issues. And you're bad for eating that food, too much food. The first thing you do is, who told you you're bad? How is that bad? Look deeply into it. This is now contemplation. Realize that, do I really feel bad when I look? When you look at it, you go, do I really feel bad when I'm eating that Hostess thing, that Twinkie, now that they're back?
Supposedly they're not as good as they were before. I talked to a guy in the restaurant who swore he had a Twinkie that it was not as good as when Hostess owned it.
But I can tell you right now that the last Twinkie I had was probably in the 70s or maybe the 60s. They weren't any good then. I can't imagine how they deep fry those suckers. But anyway, must be full of grease. But and by the way, for your listeners, I was not a pristine eater, you know, or anything like that. I ate everything, and I was a good cook. I cooked leg of lamb and stuff. God, that makes me sick to think of it. But anyway, the truth is that you look very carefully at where you got the idea that you're bad, where you got the idea that that's too much. Because just getting past the idea that eating too many Twinkies is not a good thing, because somebody told you it was a bad thing, you got to get beyond that. You got to look at that. And why is it a bad thing? Maybe our bodies can handle all this. Jack Schwartz, you know, who worked here, wrote a book in 1988 called It's Not What You Eat, But What Eats You. And he was convinced, and I think he was 100% right, with the right mental attitude, you can stuff your face with anything. You're not going to get fat. You're not going to have any toxic residue. Your bacteria is going to be fine in your colon, because really it is a matter of mind over matter. But the problem is, for us, when we believe that it's going to be bad, it does make it bad. It makes it fattening. It makes it all the things that we don't want. And there's a lot to say about belief, and we need to take you need to take your client to that on that trail to understand that it's about belief. And the only way for them to fully get it, I think, is to really start this meditation and learn about the beliefs and how they affect them. Because every one of those things, I'm a bad person, I'm a shit, whatever it is that they've picked up, which probably wasn't really intended, is something that is a belief. And they want to break the back of that belief. And the only way to break it is you can't crack it, you look at it, and it dissolves. And the power of that, it's really true, the power of that does suggest what maybe whoever it was that came up with Superman was trying to suggest and didn't know it. X-ray vision, you burn it away. Mm-hmm. You just burn it away by looking at it. You just keep looking. Every time it arises, I'm a shit. You look at it and it, you go and you start laughing. Eventually, you just start laughing.
Because you just notice that it's not you. It's just this message that you picked up somewhere.
It's a message. Absolutely. And you just keep doing it. And it's liberating.
Well, that was you actually answered my next question, which is that it doesn't just take one time, right? You can't just look at it and go, okay, well, that's gone, because it's just gonna, it's like programmed. So then it's like, I mean, does it ever really go away, or do you get to the point where you just laugh at it and you don't act from it? And it's just, there that is again. And then you're just moving on.
You got it. Because what happens is if you try to fight it, you're just going to strengthen it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. You're fighting. You don't want to engage in a fight with a belief that you've held for a long time, that you've worked really hard to try and prove that your mom or your dad or your teacher was right, that you fail. You don't want to engage that. You just want to go, that's, you can just say that to yourself, that's interesting, and move forward.
Okay.
Basically, you're saying that's crap and I'm moving forward. Uh-huh. And that's fine. And also recognize that that's crap, you said it, and you're moving forward. Uh-huh. To keep yourself in the present with where you're going. And it moves you slowly, but it moves you permanently. It does change. That's why when you tell somebody to go off dairy when they have inflammation, you tell them, do it for at least 2 months, not 2 weeks, not 2 days, because it takes a while to really ingrain that and change the body chemistry. And you're going to be changing, when you do these changes of belief, you're going to change the chemistry in your brain. It does change, and you start thinking differently. And you can feel that. That is something you can actually feel and know. And I know that when... Mr. Schwartz, Jack, used to examine people with what do you call those things, biofeedback equipment with brainwaves. He noticed changes in brainwave patterns as people proceeded in with some of the aphorisms and stuff that he gave them.
Okay. So one of the things I want to – aphorisms. You mentioned Jack Schwartz and the aphorisms. So one thing I want to touch upon, we don't have to necessarily do it right now, but I want in this conversation, I want to talk about positive thinking. Because there's a lot of thing, maybe it was my upbringing, but I'm not necessarily a proponent of like, if you just think positively, it's gonna, I think that that's almost a cheat in a way. It can be. Just like I think just because you sit on a pillow and look at a candle, you're somehow enlightened, I think is a cheat also. When you say aphorisms, I mean, well, let's get down to belief. I mean, it's easy to say you need to believe that you can do this, but how does that actually manifest? Like, how can you, if you don't believe you can do it, how do you change to believing you can do it? I mean, you can't just turn on a switch. And I think it's a cheat to say, I believe I can because I say I can. I mean, can be a disconnect there.
There's several issues here that you've raised. The first thing that I think you should do, or you know, is to provide books with great uplifting stories in them about dogs, about people, about grandparents, about miracles at Christmas, about, you know, the acts of kindness by strangers. I think we need to surround people. If you're troubled, you got to surround yourself with good news, not bad news. You don't need to reinforce the bad stuff, reinforce the good stuff. Don't go to the horror film just because it makes you feel better that, you know, you don't think this could really happen to you or whatever. Don't put energy there. Put the energy in stuff that's positive. That's quite a bit different than thinking positively. We're talking about reading good stories, seeing uplifting movies, watching fun and also it's oftentimes inane shows like 30 Rock. Great stuff. Make yourself feel better. by distracting yourself, if you will. That's good. But the most important part about that is reading much more than television, and reading those things like little miracle stories, stories about people's thinking about angels. You don't have to believe in it. Just read them. Just keep reading them, because it changes your mind. It puts you in that picture. You become one of the people in the story, and it starts changing your mind. Don't worry about what you believe. Just read it. The other thing, I think that's a very good way to move in that direction. The other thing, in terms of believing or positive thinking works, but boy, it's much harder than they make it out to be. Let's look at a ski jumper. So most of us have watched the Olympics, and they've seen one of the jumpers go behind that big stage thing where they have to come off. They mount themselves to go down that slope. And you'll see them, kind of ducking their head, bending their head down, almost like prayer. And you'll see their body kind of moving as if they're going through the jump, which in fact they are. They're going through a complete rehearsal of that jump. They are smelling the air. They're sensing the air. They're told to use all their senses, all the sounds they might hear, which is probably a whoosh, but they might hear cowbells ring and things like that. But they put all that in. So there's their smell, their sight, their sound, maybe even taste of if it's snowing. And then there's the muscular action. It's almost like in a dream, but you'll actually see them make a little effort like they were going to be pushing off from a squat. And they completely do a rehearsal of that jump. That's positive thinking. That's taking a situation that you think you're going to be entering in, or an interview or anything like that, not just ski jumping, and rehearsing it completely, moving it towards the end that you want to see it, a successful jump, a successful interview, a callback. And that is real positive thinking. That's how you really do it. You do these rehearsals. You put yourself there. You imagine yourself in that room. You imagine what the air smells like, whether you smell the wood or the varnish that they put on the wood, the carpet, that smells too, whether there's somebody drinking coffee. You imagine the people there. Then you imagine them asking you a question, have a seat, you know, telling you to sit down, and, you know, could you give us your name, or can you tell us about your previous work history? And you give them the work history, and you go through the whole thing using your imagination. That's how you do positive thinking. The other kind of thinking where you go, I'm going to start a restaurant. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Without the work, without making the contacts and all that, it doesn't work. What does work is imagining the hard work of going there, everything about it, and getting it right. And pretty soon, the energy around you, and we haven't spoken about energy around people, auras and stuff like that, but the energy around you changes, as well as that chemistry in your brain, the biophysical parts. And things change and things happen, and you become a different person than the person who first thought, I need to do something magical, some magical thinking. It isn't magical. It's hard work. Angels have muscles. They're not cherubs floating around up there. You have to work.
Yeah. I mean, my last episode, which was called Ask and You Shall Receive, and it was about that whole the secret, like the magical, like I want a BMW and the universe will provide you with it, you know. And my thing was like, what you should ask is, what is in conflict with yourself? What are those things? Because I think what happens is, it's real easy to say, you know, let's say you're 100 pounds overweight. There's, to me, in most cases, there's probably some behavioral or thinking patterns that got you to the point where you're not nourishing your body in that way. You don't believe that you're, who knows? It's a whole plethora of things. I'm not worthy of treating myself well, all these kinds of messages. It's inauthentic to then, because some person says, just believe that you can lose 100 pounds. It's just not that simple. So what you're saying is, take the time to go through the process of what it would be like to lose the 100 pounds. I mean, that's what you're saying?
And what you can do with that less 100 pounds less, and the joy.
Picture yourself at 100 pounds less.
Yeah.
So okay. So here, before you go, because I know where you're. So then, and I found this in myself. So like then you're, let's say you do that, and you're picturing yourself 100 pounds less, right? But then there's that little thing that comes up and goes,
the doubt.
Right. Okay. So what? And then do you just look at that?
You look at it.
Right. So this is the frustration. So this is the frustration. What happens is that you have this feeling that this, I can do, you know, you picture it and you can picture yourself 100 pounds less. Then the thing goes, no, you can never do that. And in meditation, sometimes I'll be running and I'm trying to listen. And then all of a sudden my mind wanders. And then I listen again, my mind wanders and I get frustrated. I feel myself get frustrated because I'm like, why can't I just freaking listen for like 5 minutes? Why can't you, right? And that's just that constant cycle. So I know there's a lot of things going on there, but I just, what do you, and there's probably like eight questions in that thing, but how does that, the frustration of those things coming up repeatedly, how do you?
The first thing you want to do is say, that's life. That's the way it works. Every time I want to do something, my mind wanders. It makes it a hell of a lot easier to deal with that when you go, that happens, and don't get in conflict with the fact that it happens. Don't get mad at yourself. It just happens.
No matter what.
And you smile. Eventually, you want to be able to smile at yourself. So you can do this as an imagination, as a psychophysical rehearsal. I'm borrowing a term from Jack Schwartz, but a PPR, he called it. But basically, you do that. You encompass that. You go, oh, as you're doing your ski jump thought. You think of yourself looking over at the crowd, at the cowbell ringer. I don't like that cowbell ringer. And then you got to smile at yourself. You got to basically say, oh, and then go through the whole thing again. But you keep doing it. You'll get better and better each time. The problem we have as in this society and probably everywhere else is we want it instantly. I did not work that way for me. It doesn't work that way for me. Nothing ever has been instant. It happens eventually, and you have to have that trust, but you don't even need that trust. You just own what goes on in your life without fighting it. So as you're running along and you're no longer listening to whatever it is you want to listen and you get frustrated, own it. I own that frustration and go off with the frustration. Feel the frustration. Boy, does it go away fast when you look at it. That's one thing I've learned, and I have a lot of frustration in my life, as you know.
Right. So can you, I know that I'm, you know, a large source of that. And can you?
No, but the people you work with are.
Can you know that?
Can we name names on this podcast?
Sure. People in Australia won't really care. Yeah. But when you say, well, this is a conjecture, but when you say, when you look at that frustration, it goes away.
It really does.
It has to. Right? Because if you're looking at the frustration and it's all one thing and you're not looking at it, you're frustrated because you're looking at it. Right. Okay.
That's the trick. Once you look at it, that condition is gone.
Because it's not two separate people.
It's become past.
Right. Because it's not two separate.
Yeah. It pulls you into the present and all of a sudden you realize, I'm looking at that and it's gone. I mean, the vitality that this gives you, the energy it gives you to deal with very complex and miserable situations that come up in our daily lives is amazing, like death when you don't expect it.
Uh-huh.
All those things are amazing. What happens when you pay attention? All you're doing is paying attention to what's going on without that judgment, without judging your frustration, and that just makes you more frustrated. You just go, oh, I was going to swear. Oh, damn.
You already swore. It's cats out of the bag on this one.
Yeah.
You said the S word.
No, I was saying the F word.
No, but you did say the S word already.
I did.
For the record. So you might as well say the F word. I mean,
I'm not going to say the F
word. Okay. I mean, you're just saying you could.
I could have.
Because we were already going to.
Because, I just did that again. That's a great recognition. Don't condemn yourself for it. But already in that statement, it's a condemnation, and you see that too.
Mm-hmm.
You can get lost in seeing your responses to everything, which is fine because everything is a response to everything else.
Right.
You're constantly moving, and what you're responding to is your own, think of it, what's outside of you. Everything is within your consciousness. You just keep responding to stuff within it, and eventually it subsides and becomes that absolutely quiet lake, that undisturbed sky. And you're it.
Okay.
And, I mean, that's so easy to say and so hard to accomplish, but it's actually instantaneous when it's accomplished.
Right. But it is. But obviously, I'm the small step advocate. I'm going to clue into the fact that you said it takes a long time, that you can't expect that thing to occur and that you do it and you just keep doing it. And just like with your own health, and it's interesting that you mentioned that just the consciousness and you're reacting. Cause I, of course, when I talk about the body, I say, you know, our bodies are always doing literally trillions of things, interacting with the environment. And in a way, what I'm hearing you say is kind of your consciousness is the same way. You're trying to find it. Is it, do you, well, put it this way, do you think it's part of our design to achieve that balance? Do you, with our consciousness, with are we designed to seek that? Are we designed to, I touched upon this in a conversation we had a couple of days ago, that why is this a human thing? Why is meditation a human thing? Why do we even need to? Why do we even need to make an effort to do any of that stuff when, I mean, is that part of our natural design? Where do you see us sitting in that regard?
Well, since you just asked 100,000 questions,
I know, I'm
in
sorry.
A period of
answer them all now. No. Well, first start here with the way that I see the body interacting with the environment. How do you see, first of all, how do you see the consciousness in that regard, in that same kind of way?
Well, first of all, I think that one of the things that we recognize as human beings that we're not sure that other beings recognize, we can recognize consciousness in them, that they are aware and that they're aware of themselves. There's all this science that's worked, and you know we've got all those magazines around here like Science and Nature and New Scientist that I read, or some of our guests read. The point being that consciousness of choice is, I think, unique to human beings. And that puts upon us a huge responsibility. And considering how destructive we are to ourselves, and everything else is an extension of ourselves, so somebody's thinking, oh, what the hell, I don't care if I pollute, I don't care if I drive a car that gets only 6 miles to the gallon where I could be driving one that gets 25. That kind of stuff, they'll find out. They're only the ones there anyway that are affected. We all seem to think we're affected, but if you start looking at your life, think about what's really affecting you, what's really encroaching upon you, and you'll find yourself to be far less encroached upon than you think, and find out where your real freedom is, and that's in your thought, in your mind, in your being, in the art, because I believe living is an art. And when we accept it as an art, then we'll learn from it, and what we do is we learn how to live. I'm sorry, I got completely off the track, but it sounded good.
Well, I had 100,000 questions, so it was only natural that you would have an answer that was not to
relevant
any
to
one
it.
Of them.
Well, but, you know, I was trying to – there was something that came up when we were doing this, but, that, you know, when you're talking about all these things, and that is that the very nature of life is what you're calling into question. We're here – and the best thing we can do is explore it, go out there, find out what it's about. And when you go out there, you find out that you're really going in there because whatever it is that's out there, you're responding to, whatever it is. And those responses are telling you the nature of who you are.
And what I'm hearing you say, and this really is maybe a better way for me to say this question, but you're responding to those things no matter what.
Right.
Period. So you can either be aware of those or not, but
right.
you're designed to respond. That's what I'm kind of getting at. Your body's already responding to the temperature and the food you eat and everything
else. If you don't respond, you're dead.
Right. So you already are responding.
Right.
So just like with nourishing your body, you can choose to make to work in a way work, but whatever. But it's not laborious necessarily. But to be aware of that response, of those response patterns,
right,
that might exist.
Yes.
And you can change them over time.
You can.
Right.
And what changes them is the awareness. You're not saying, I'm going to change that, because that doesn't work too well, and we're really self-destructive. How many people that do we know that says, I'm going to go vegan or vegetarian because it's a healthy thing to do, and then you see them 2 years later, and they're no longer vegan or vegetarian. Oh, I'm on the raw meat diet. Why? Because it's more healthy for me. They're very self-destructive. They may have the science in front of them of what is really good for them, but they constantly are bouncing around because they're not happy with themselves. And the only way to become happy with yourself is to pay attention to yourself. Get to know who you are. And it's an amazing process. And it's amazing because pretty soon you find out, I know even less who I am now than when I started that path to find out who I was. I thought I knew who I was and I was going to find out more. And what you find is you look at yourself, you dissolve away. All those conflicts and all that, which are part of you, dissolve. And you start becoming more, and you don't know what that is. And then life just keeps unfolding and unfolding and unfolding. I've been looking at this for a long time, since I went in college. What does that mean in terms of where you go towards death? I think it means you just keep unfolding. You just keep learning. And I see you dialing a dial.
I'm dialing a dial. So for people who are not watching, there's going to be a video on this, but this is not me urinating. This is me refilling my cup of coffee.
No, but it is a tape of him urinating.
Would you like some more coffee?
Yes.
We got to have coffee during these discussions. Okay, so now we're getting into a little
When you came in here for an interview about consciousness, and I mean, you know, you thought you were being interviewed for a job. Did we have coffee?
When I came in and interviewed 7 years ago, we did not have coffee. We might have had coffee.
Yeah, there you go.
Start and here we are. 7 years later, I think we did have coffee.
Yeah, yes. After a pool full of coffee that each of us has drunk.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't want to think about that. Anyway, so now, I mean, and obviously expand on anything that you can expand on, but
my stomach
bigger and bigger. There you go. Talk about mindfulness.
I'm giving myself stuff to work with.
I know exactly. Mindfulness. I should probably reference that he and I kind of oversee the kitchen and we go down there sometimes and we both, if we're in a conversation especially, we're just nibbling. And it's just it's like to get that awareness in that moment, that's always the struggle. Anywho, for the person that is just an average person. Busy kids. I mean, these are the people I work with. These are the people, hopefully, that have gotten to the point where they're over the quick fix. They're finally like, okay, nothing else is working. Like, what can I do something different? But people are busy. So in a very practical sense, and that's what we focus on, how does somebody day-to-day begin this path in a way that's not super stressful, in a way that is going to move them along at whatever pace is comfortable for them, but starting tomorrow morning, how would you coach somebody in that regard, or how do you coach people in that regard?
I don't. I actually don't coach people at all in that regard.
Well, how would you advise? I'll put it that way.
Well, Lord, I do that, and when people talk to me about it, and I'll deal with everything, and I'll deal with sex or whatever. But I think that what you're looking for is how to remember yourself, self-remembering. Gurdjieff called it that. He was a Russian psychic and a Russian philosopher. I think the way to do this self-remembering is that when you're during the day, and if you start thinking about, God, this didn't work out well, or what the fuck, this guy's driving like shit in front of me, you know, whatever it is. Just take a deep breath. I'm not an advocate for breathing lessons or anything. Just take a deep breath. Bring the air in. And just as it's going out, just when you're ready to go out, kind of look up and just release. Don't think about anything. Don't think about I'm going to release. Just go up there and just release the air and just feel your body for that microsecond or a second. That's all. That's actually a meditation. Just do it. And don't try and push it. Don't try to drag it out to 5 minutes or anything more than one half a second or 1 second or whatever it takes. 1 second meditation. That's really what you want to do. But you want to get present. And the way you do that is just feel your body. Because when you look up, you'll feel your neck against the collar of your shirt. Or you'll feel the back of the car seat if you're in traffic and you're stopped. Don't do this when you're driving. Warning.
Yeah.
But or walking downstairs or on ice. There's a lot of ice in some places. Don't do that at a bar if there's no back to the chair. I'm thinking of all the precautions that we have.
Very practical knowledge. Yeah.
Just look up and release that breath. That's all I want you to do, and that's all you need to do. And while you do that, just notice your body. Just notice it. Don't go, oh, my foot's behind the chair leg right now because I'm sitting in a chair that way. Don't think of that. Just notice your body and then go on about your business.
Which everybody has time to do.
Everybody has time to do this.
Because I think, you know, again, I'm going to come back to this because this is what I'm dealing with, real life stuff. And I think that the perception of meditation is like, well, if I were retired and had a ton of money, yes, I could meditate. I could go to my room with a pillow and I could get all this and that. And then I'm either going to do that or I can't do that at all. And I think the reason why I wanted to really sit down and get into this with you is because this is not only is it totally possible, it's necessary, it's what we're human, it's human beings. Can you say that this is natural?
I think it's totally natural. And I think that the, I don't think there was the noble savages or anything like that. I was an anthropologist. But what I really do think is that people want space in their life for this kind of thing. And that space was organized in ways in other societies better than perhaps than we're doing now. People might have been performing some kind of ritual, praying to the east, whatever it is, chanting and all that, but they get bored with it. And what that boredom allows them to do is to start just listening to themselves chant. It didn't matter what they were chanting or what the meaning of it was. They just start listening to themselves chanting because it becomes so automatic. That's a good thing, actually. It created space because you're just doing it. I like mantra-type meditations because what it does is it numbs the brain. It just, you know, you're just, if you got to do it because Maharishi said so, then do it. But what that numbing allows the creative forces to actually come out for a lot of people. I don't advocate that kind of work because I don't think it is the best way to go. But I advocate the kind of meditation that I just said, that one second or one half a second meditation of one breath. The other meditation that I recommend is if you really want to sit around and you're in a, you want to try meditation, you know, I have an idea for you. Just listen for the silence. Listen for the gaps because there's always noise around us. There's the noise of fans on your central heating system. There's the noise of cars going by. There's the noise of the wind in the trees. It's pretty much always continuous unless you're out in the woods and there's absolutely nothing going on. Then there's the sound of insects and all that. When you're listening for the silence, you'll hear everything unless you've got a hearing problem. Listen for the silence. Just listen for the silence. That's all you're doing. You don't have to think about anything else. You don't have to think what it means. When your thought goes, that's a cricket, just let it go. Listen for the silence. And that is a very powerful way to get into meditation. And I'll tell you, with my own experience, it can take you to the, literally, it sounds so weird, to the far corners of the universe. But it does. It can really, something happens. Just listen for the silence.
Okay. And then it doesn't preclude, I'm getting very mundane here, but I keep wanting to come back to this, but it doesn't preclude getting things done, taking the kids to school, all the things that we have to do in our lives. You can do that and take little micro moments throughout the day. And what does that do for you is that the more you do that, the more aware and attentive you are during the day.
You want to take taking the kids to school to become a meditation. You want to take walking the dog and picking up the dog's poop a meditation. You want to be present with it in everything. If you're not doing anything, then you have to fake it. And faking it is listening for the silence, for example.
Okay.
You know, like you're laying in bed, you're not really tired, your wife's beside you, your girlfriend's beside you, your boyfriend's beside you, whatever it is, your dog is beside you, and you start listening for the silence. And all you hear is the damn dog breathing. But the point is, that's outside of the ordinary goings on in daily life.
Right.
You want all the things that are ordinary, the pushing the pencil like I have to do, you know, doing the complete audit of all the stuff that we spent in 2013, which I've got to do, that kind of stuff, that becomes a meditation in itself. And it's a meditation because you're totally present with us. You know, read some things like Zen and the Art of Archery or that the guy about the art of bicycle, Prizik's book on bicycle riding, whatever. Get into it. Read positive stuff where people were very present with whatever was happening, and that'll help you be more present. If you know you're talking to your clients and that, tell them that. Be positive. Read this stuff. Don't read stuff that's considered really great literature because all it does is going to throw you in turmoil because your life ain't organized yet.
You don't mean Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, do you?
That's it. Motorcycle. Okay. I thought it was bicycles.
No, I read that one. I was like, is there a bicycle one? Because that'd be fun.
It's, well, you know, those people that visited the other day, they really are talking about using a bicycle as a mindfulness tool.
Well, I mean, that was one of my favorite books, that book by Persig years ago. I mean, it was great.
But there's also one, Zen and the Art of Archery, too.
Yeah, so I'd never heard of that one.
You never heard? Well, no. He based his book on that, I believe.
Okay.
And that's becoming one with the arrow, so it goes where you want it to go. Now, I did archery, and I did understand that. I remember it from when I was a kid. You just are so present with it. The damn thing just, it's like, wow, that's a miracle. Yeah. I went to a camp near San Antonio one time, and they had all the parents came. My parents didn't because they were 1,000 miles away. But and we had to shoot this little, use like 22 and shoot a matchbox with a sand in it. And I didn't think I could do it. I had that same experience as that archery experience. And it was like, I remember it so thoroughly today. I pulled the trigger, and it was like I was the box that blew up, you know, the sand came out. It goes poof. Yeah. The sand comes out like 50 yards away or wherever it is. The point is, that happens. The point is, though, I didn't try to make it happen. Uh-huh. If I tried to make that happen, I would have gotten in the way because I'm clumsy. Every time I try to do something, I get up on ice skates, my ankle's going to bend. If I forget that my ankle's going to bend and I've got to get over there to get my daughter out of the pressure ridge of ice, I'm not going to have any damage at all because I'm just skating over there to get there as fast as possible.
This is great. Yeah, and this is exactly what we were talking about, is like the more present you are, then the messages of my ankle's going to crumble, all those kinds of things are just...
They go away.
They're just not there.
They're not there.
I remember. Do you remember a book called The Inner Game? Inner Game of Tennis. Did you ever play tennis? I played tennis in high school in Houston.
Yes, I did.
Inner Game of Tennis by Timothy Galway. Did you ever read that book?
I did not read the book, but I'm aware of it.
But what's funny is that, I mean, now I'm thinking about it. This hasn't even come up for me, but I don't know why. But I read that in high school, and he is literally, that's active meditation. He's talking about you watching your hand as you do the forehand. Just you're just watching your racket go by. It's exactly what he's talking about. And just that place of being present.
Being really present and not worrying about whether you're going to beat the guy across there or going to impress him or something like that. Yeah, I played varsity tennis for a very short time. My anger and upset in my life at that time was really, really high.
Were you John McEnroe of your...
I was worse. And I believe I cost my father way too much money, probably a few classes in universities in terms of tennis rackets. I cost him way too much money in tennis rackets. Those were wooden ones, and I'd find out how high they could bounce, and boy, they could go up there. But when I was relaxed, I played really well, and this is actually all true. I've learned a huge amount by playing a good, really good tennis player, and if he's out there and hears this stuff, John Tanner, I thank you. He was like nationally ranked. He was good. But I learned a lot about how horrible my temper was. Mm-hmm. Boy, and I earned that one. I mean, I learned it really thoroughly from my family.
But the idea of meditation and contemplation, the reason why it's interesting to me, especially as a health coach, is because it is to be and can be applied. It's not something that's so esoteric and something that's new for new agey people that they do meditation. Just like I always say, health isn't for people who are into health. It's for humans. And I really like where you're going with this, is that you make everything that you do in your life, no matter what your life is can be a meditation if you want to make it a meditation.
And it's totally transformative. I see it. I read about it with a person that I know that's in prison now, who has transformed his life in a way that when he was brought to my attention, I was asked to write him, would not have been imaginable, not even conceivable, by the people that brought him to my attention. And he did it all on his own because he just has become more and more present. He still questions that, but that's the nature of it. It just takes time. You become more and more present, and then you slip off the wagon and you become more present again. It's a process. We are not perfect. And we've got to engage that lack of perfection and enjoy it and relish it, because it makes life so interesting. I'm telling you, we're just not there, and that's fine.
And for a guy like the guy you're talking about who you write to in prison, you're not saying, hey, just say, hey, this is great. I mean, what you're saying is, even in that situation, which for most of us would just be like, oh my God, it's the worst idea, worst thing in the world, you are talking to him about just what you talked to me about.
Yeah, making it practical, like your book. And by the way, for those of you who don't know about his book is awesome. It is The Small Steps, because some people can do it all at once, but they do that, they achieve it after that fatal heart attack or at the time of the fatal heart attack or whatever causes them to transform or transcend them. This life that we lead. This life is, the perfection in this life is that it's not perfect, and there's always change. That's the one thing you can say. And people want to, oh, this is just so perfect right now. I want to hold it. It's like, you know, you can't. It's like that sexual experience where you're so present. And then, of course, it's gone. It doesn't stay. But the point is that that process is wonderful. And if you really deeply get into that and enjoy that, your life is just starts opening up and you're more fulfilled in the lack of fulfillment in a way.
Interesting. Because you can look at that and be okay with it. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
Very liberating.
Yeah. It's the whole, I've looked at it when working with people here. So we look like an inn here. We're not an inn. We're about some social experimentation. Some of it's been really a failure. But what we've always done, my wife and I, and now Sid has joined us, is to give people more freedom, to give them the tools to find that freedom. For example, we want them to learn English so that they have more freedom to find a better job than what we might offer, or they can move to a different part of the country if they're Hispanic, or we've had some even from Italy. But the point is that we want to give them all the tools to give them greater freedom in their lives. It's surprising to me, but there are many people who don't want greater freedom, psychological, economic, sociological, all of it. But the most painful is they don't want psychological freedom. And that's what we're talking about today. Meditation, of the two kinds that we're talking about, object meditation, where you're really trying to get and understand something through observation, and just presentness meditation, they both provide way greater degrees of freedom. I didn't say that well, but that's what you're moving towards. It's greater freedom. You have greater freedom, and the freedom is there. And one of the freedoms that you have, and you really need to see, somebody needs to see, I'm kind of talking to you or your clients, is the freedom to choose your life. And most people don't choose their life. And that's the sad thing. They are in conflict with their life. All this stuff about Krishnamurti and all the stuff that we've been talking about today is to see that conflict and get rid of that conflict so that you actually, in effect, choose your life. You embrace that which is, you know, which is joyful.
And when you understand that really it essentially comes down to you finally get that you really can choose your life. And when you can choose your life, then you don't need to think, I know I can lose 100 pounds. You really do know that you can lose 100 pounds because you're choosing your life at that point.
Right. I mean, but the choice is first you got to choose your 250 pounds.
Right.
You choose that person.
Yeah.
You're not in conflict with that person anymore. I love my 250-pound body, and I'm going to talk to that body. You're great. You're handling all that stress that I've given to you as the more conscious thermostatic kind of ego that's out there in the world. You're handling all that stress, all that information that you didn't know what to deal with, that you got from our mom and our dad and all that, talk in the plural because it is kind of pluralistic. Yeah. We got all that, and you're handling that well. You're stuffing it. I'm big. We're big. That's fantastic. I love you for that because we wouldn't have survived and we would have had to maybe do this all again. Maybe there is reincarnation. Who knows? But the important thing is you're helping me, the ego part of me, to survive. And when you start working this way, which is one of the ways I work with myself, you find out that the body happens to be the body that you say is too big, too fat, too uncoordinated, ugly's got acne, whatever it is that you have against yourself. You find out that that body is actually a beautiful thing because it's the instrument for which you know about higher selves, for which you know about people that aren't necessarily incarnate. It all comes through the body. It doesn't come through your intellect. And you need to really appreciate and grasp and hold and embrace our bodies for what they are, not for what you want them to be, what we want them
first,
to be,
to
embrace who we are now. That's the transformative experience. That's where it's at. And it's in the present. It isn't embracing, I'll embrace your body when you're 150 pounds.
Right,
it isn't that at all. It's, I embrace you now for 250 pounds because you are keeping us alive and handling it. There's some disease, there's some worry, there's a lot of frustration, and there's a lot of anguish, but it's way better than not being here.
Uh-huh. And that's a place to start.
It's where you start where you are.
Yeah.
And most people want to start when they
Once I do this, then I'll be happy. Once I do this, then I'll get a better job.
It's like that restaurant analogy that we gave. You know, I want to do this restaurant. Well, I can't. I don't have any money. So you start doing it in a different way. You start providing. I met a guy, smelled really bad. He was quite the hippie. But what he wanted to do was wonderful. He wanted to get a truck eventually and put, you know, vegan food in it and take it to disaster sites and feed people extremely well. What a beautiful thing to do. That might be how you start your restaurant. You use the truck you already got.
But once you, so what I'm totally getting, this is a great place to kind of wrap this up, is that if you, when you start from that place, you actually create a foundation that you can actually act from.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you say, once I can lose 100 pounds, it's just, you're just shutting yourself off from any activity. Because I'm going to start a restaurant. Well, if I don't have $100,000, then I guess I can't start a restaurant. But you're saying is, you, if you just accept where you're at, then you can do something.
What can you do now?
Yeah. You want to establish what can
I'll
you...
I'll feed the neighbors.
Yeah, fine. Let me start there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then the action begets more action.
Absolutely. And life is fuller because you're not ever coming from... the other way, you're always coming from what you don't have. The way I'm suggesting is you're coming from what you do have. And that makes life a hell of a lot easier because you can't walk on nothing. You can only walk on... we're physical. It's real out there. It hurts to fall on the floor. So stand on the floor and stand on the floor and do something instead of an imaginary floor. Magical thinking doesn't really work. Being very present does. And that is magical. Things change. People change. They find out about things and energies and things. They are transformed. It's like the doctor, the scientist, having a near-death experience and then saying, there is something way beyond what I understand here. I don't understand anything anymore. That happens to people. So the thing to do is to stand where you are and get that and move forward. And once you do that, you don't. The universe is the is where you're moving into. You're moving into the universe and things change, and I can't predict anybody, what, you know, how somebody's going to perceive that, right, or what the wonderful things are that's going to happen to them. And they shouldn't expect anything. They should just expect that it's a hell of a lot easier to act from what you've got and embrace what you are than those things that you don't have and those things you are not. Like a 250-pound person trying to be a 150-pound ballerina. I mean, the toes.
Just from the toes alone. Why would you ever want that life?
I always think it's good. And don't take it seriously. Because if you're like me, you fuck up all the time. There it is. I use the word twice or three times now.
I think it's like three.
Three.
Yeah, I've been counting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I have
to charge.
Yeah,
I see the towel.
You see the towel.
But the point is that I do. And the thing is, okay, that's great.
Yeah.
And try to make it a great story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make it funny because nobody cares what your pain is.
Yeah.
They just want to be amused. So amuse them.
Yeah.
Or do a Chevy Chase pratfall from the 1975 SNL.
Exactly. Just to cover it, however you... just to make it fun.
Yes.
Anyway.
But be careful. Stay away from broomsticks and chair edges where you can hurt delicate parts
when
of your body.
When you pratfall.
Yes.
Okay. Of all the things we talked about, that was the most practical and important tip. So I'm just going to cut everything up to that point, and we'll just leave that little 30-second thing.
There's the truth.
There is the truth. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Dumb and most things. I'd see more clearly than I've ever seen. And if I were you, maybe this would be untrue. And maybe problems lie so deep that they cannot be